Accession number 31971, Reel 2.
Are you surprised? You volunteered to go to war. What was your impression of it when you were in your first action, when you were involved in your first action? You mentioned 8,000 people.
Oh, yes. Oh, you were very, very proud of the fact that you were one of them that went in. And you were very more thankful you were one that came out. Yes, oh yes.
Did you ever feel that you made a mistake and you wish you hadn't volunteered?
No, never. I'll tell you one thing I did. I often thought of my mother. The feeling that she must have had.
Right.
You know, young and irresponsible. Computers of new barns, as it were. We were very proud. And the king, he came 3 times to see us, and he also came twice to France to see us. That was the Ulster Commission. Yes, the king, he gave us a great talk. He came and inspected us. No, we were all very proud indeed. We had a great division. Great division indeed. And they were just as enthusiastic as I was. But, candidly, I would do it over again. Of course, you know more now than you knew then, but at the same age, you didn't have the responsibility on your shoulders that you have today. And you just wanted to be one of the few. That's my impression, isn't it? No regrets whatever. And I was the last indentured 7-year apprentice in the city of Belfast in 1912. But any questions you have, don't be afraid to fire them off. I'll do my best to answer them.
You'll have to speak up because the rain makes it happen here.
What was it like between the British and the Germans? What was it like between the British and the Germans? Say, like you said, when you're wounded, they helped you and that sort of thing. Were they, on Christmas time, did you get together with them and that sort of thing? You know, was the fighting you did sort of more honourable than it is today, or was it sort of just, you know, he was the enemy and you wanted to kill him, or were you more sort of, was the fighting more sort of honourable?
Respect.
Yeah, did you sort of respect the other side and when you were fighting and that sort of thing?
Oh, believe me, there's always chivalry prevailing, but when you went into action, it was either you or him. And that was the feeling that prevailed. But you didn't do him in cold blood or anything like that. You threw his arms up to the city, and that's all it was doing. And I was involved in a motor accident in Germany. I was in Hamburg Hospital for over 3 months, and believe me, they called me the Herr Englander whilst I was there. But nicer people I never met, and I probably listened and see more festivities over the Christmas period than I would have saw in England. And every day before Christmas, school children came up, and everyone could play a recorder, and they played a carol. A little boy, a little green leaf on your bed. And the first Sunday before Lent, when they brought your breakfast in, being in a private ward, I had to have a tray brought in to me, and one candle. First Sunday in Lent, second Sunday in Lent, 2 candles. Now this was all in German. And I spoke to the Oberschwester, as you call it there, because it was such a big hospital, 2-story buildings, you know. Each block had its own matrix of work. And I spoke to her one day and I asked her, did she realize that there was a camp they called Belsen, so close to Hamburg? She said, Herr Timmel, we didn't know such places existed. And what's more, we were afraid to ask questions. Very good, and the doctors were very good, really good. When I was fixing this hip up and saw this mark on a a sergeant says to me, "Herr Trimble, what thing?" That's the way. And I said, "You're a war wound." Well, he says, "Too bad." But no. There's good people amongst them all. Good. Mind you, the Nazi element wasn't the real German. They're not all angels, I know, but there's some good amongst them, believe me. I think there was more good amongst them than there was amongst some of the French. That was my opinion.
Any further questions?
Well, Rain was a Nazi Rain. That could happen just about. You know, that could happen in quite a few countries. Could it happen in Austria or anywhere?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. Oh, yes. Well, of course, the Austrian is very similar to the German, aren't they?
As far as leave was concerned.
Leave?
Yeah, how much leave and what was involved in leave?
When the opportunity of sending you on leave and things was quiet, you got 10 days leave.
So
that's all. That could have been 12 months. You had to get wounded. Where to get?
Right.
You get brought home.
And what were your options for leave? Where could you go?
He went home.
You went home.
Just 10 days. He went home. Mm. Went home to your mother and father.
And were you pleased to be home, or
were you delighted to get home? It was very, very difficult coming away in the car. It was all a crying match.
Right.
It was very difficult leaving your mother. The last time when I was wounded and had to go back to the front again, I got my father to tell my mother. I got away early in the morning and never told her because I couldn't face up to it. I got my father to tell her. But it was difficult leaving home. In those days, at first it didn't mean a thing. You thought you were a hero. And once you got the kid and her back, you were away. Oh, yes. I think the same prevails amongst all ages, you know. Particularly the younger and better. But I assure you, I felt it hard when I was leaving my wife and children when I was sailing, in my sailing bed before I was brought ashore. I felt that worse.
This is the Second World War, wasn't it?
That was the second, yes. I was brought ashore in 1941, and I had to leave Belfast and come to Liverpool. And then I became chief in 1948, and I had to come to London then, so I spent the rest of my days in London until I came out here. Came out here in 64. Sailing, I love the sea. I love the sea, and I love the ships.
What were your feelings when you were you drafted in the Second World War?
In the Second War?
Mm.
No.
You volunteered?
I was afloat.
Oh, merchant navy?
Yes.
Oh, I see. Right.
I was afloat.
Yeah.
And when the Second War broke out, we were stopped. We were trying to keep down. A cruiser came up alongside and told us that there'd been a declaration of war, and the blackened ships, that means no lights. All staterooms, cabins, and everything had to be blacked out because you couldn't give your position away to the submarine. And they took the radio, we all had little radio sets, you know. They were all taken off us because they created oscillation and give your position away to the submarine. The worst experience I think I had that was on the Graf's Bay was talked about. And when we were coming out of Cape Town, there was the Doric Star coming out with us. She was first, we were last. And as we were coming out, HMS Ark Royal Repulsion Renown came in. They were looking for the Graf's Bay, you see. So when I took the draft up to the Admiral and the captain at Cape Town, we were flagship, you see. And I gave them the depth, what we were drawing, etc. The Admiral says to me, "Get down your knees and thank God you've got this length." I said, "I don't need to do it now. I do it every night before I turn it." I says, "I have a belt, a hammer and a marlin spike and a pair of trousers at my feet." So, well, he said, "I'm telling you, But tell me, what's the reason of all this? Have to do this and have to do that. So he told me they picked up the message from the Doric Star when the Graf Spee got her. He ordered to shut her radio down, and she didn't. She kept sending her R. That was when you were being attacked. So our radio picked up the message up and shot up to the bridge and informed them. And the captain ordered all possible steam. And of course, the mast was going like this. I thought the top mast was going to fall. And hell and hard to starve it. Because what the Graf Spee was doing was running between the two coasts, the African coast and the American coast, going catching the trades coming up from Buenos Aires and out of Cape Town. And he would plan between them. And of course, that's why they couldn't find him. But when the Doric Star gave us our position, we knew where he was. And the British Navy then got on the job. But we didn't know that the action had taken place in the Graf Spee had been scuttled in Montevideo. So that night, Winston Churchill was on the radio, and we all got our radios, and we listened to the Battle of Cleveland. So that was one of the outstanding things.
Okay. And that's probably a hard one, but if you had to, going back to the First World War,
yes,
if you had to choose something that the worst thing that you can recall, that as far as the First World War was concerned, would you have something that stands out as being the worst thing that you were involved in?
Yes, I think when they captured Messines, I think it was intolerable, the conditions.
In what way?
Hardship leading up to it. Cold, wet, hungry, and then having to go and fight a battle on it. And conditions were very, very hard at Messines, and then not only that, but when you were supposed to come out for a rest, you had to go up and fill sandbags, and they did all the digging as far as making the tunnel and the avenues leading off for to blow up the German trenches in front of us. You see, Messines Ridge was like that real on the lobster there. And the Royal Engineers were putting poles in and hanging like barbed wire, the wire you fence a garden with, hanging up like that and tying pieces of bunting, different colours, as a camouflage. The Germans kept blowing them down as you possibly put them up. And of course, you could see everything that we were doing. And in those days, we used to put barrage balloons up to spot for the field artillery. And at sunset, sure as fate, a couple of Germans come over. We just set them afire. And the next thing you see was the observers coming down in the basket in the parachute. Oh, it was very, very... You see, there were streets ahead of us so far as air attacks was concerned. The Germans could fire a machine gun, and the gun synchronized with a propeller. We couldn't. What we had to do was, when you took a plane up, you had to have a Lewis gunner sitting at the back of the pilot with a gun on his knees, and he had to do this. That was our method of air battles in the first... the beginning of the First World War, but then it developed from there on. But it was difficult, really. And there used to be a fella come over and at St. John's Wood, they used to come over and he used to go along the front line. If you didn't take cover, you got it. Oh, yes. The Germans, they were no dumbbells at anything. They were well tutored and well trained. Mind you, I can't say that for the last war because I hadn't to do any manual scrapping then.
Were you involved in gas attacks?
Yes.
What can you describe? What was
well, I'll there? Tell you what. The first gas attack we got, we didn't know much about it. We had the old cloth helmets in those days. And you had to open up and get this thing away and get away down here. And before you had it on you 10 minutes, you were blind. You couldn't see out of the goggles. And the smell of it But what happened when you did? Now, I did get a slight attack at Ypres, and that's the way the gas got you, and it burned the back of your throat. Well, when you were in hospital, they treated you with the lentil, or I forget the name of the liquid that they give you, but it was boiling hot water, and they put a towel over your head, and you inhaled it. That's how they treated you. But if you got the mustard gas, it was totally different. I never experienced that.
You didn't?
No. It did burn you, there's no doubt about it. You come out in scabs then.
Were the gas masks effective?
Well, yes, but then the later gas mask we got was very effective. Very effective. And you could wear it because when you put the clip on your nose, you see, it clips on your nostrils. And of course, you can't use your nose to breathe with. You have to do everything with your mouth. And there's no pleasure in wearing them, but you realize you're wearing them for your own good.
Right.
And what the form of the alarm was, you had an 18 pounder case, a big brass case, and that was hammered with a stick, and that was the alarm for gas. Oh yes, every section of the front had these all fitted. But there was a method there at the latter end that developed. They built a mound, the engineers built a mound, just like a bank, and they fitted these projectiles at intervals of about 3 feet. Maybe they had 100 in this mound, and they were wired up to a point and every miles away, and just pressed the button and blew these over, and these were all reputed to have gas in them. And you see what happened when the Germans used the gas first, they gassed themselves, the wind blew it the other way, the wind changed, and the German troops were badly gassed when they tried to gas us. Ypres was the first place it was used, that's in Belgium. And that's another thing I should like to tell you, and I went up there on a Sunday morning when I had the opportunity after the war was over. There's 1.25 million names around the Menin Gate. All big panels, all the names of them. And the steps leading up to the Garden of Remembrance. And this museum you've got on your domain is a replica of what's on top of the Garden of Remembrance at the Menin Gate. It's just a dead replica. I used to go up on a Sunday morning, and one of the windows was our badge, and I used to sign the book every Sunday. But that indicates that you'd been there and then visited. And sunrise in the morning and sundown at night. Belgian Bugle. Union Jack was up, pulled it out, just the same as the tattoos. But that's done every day at the Menin Gate. Very impressive when you go there. This just built right across the road, and the road goes right through, and then you have two lead-ups to the garden on either side. Everything's panelled, and all the names are cut in. And it does you good to go into one of the cemeteries to see how they're preserved and how they're kept. I used to go to visit a colleague that was buried in Poppering, at behind you, please. When you went and bought a flower out of the florist, they wouldn't take the money off you. Mm. Grave. But every grave has a stone. Every grave has a stone, and the regimental badge is on the top of the stone. So, and when you go into the cemetery, they have the cross. They have a big cupboard all around, subdivided, and the books are all in there with the names. You have no difficulty. You just get there, look for the initial and get it, and look up, you find the number and you just walk to it. That's the way that all the gardens are done. Oh, it makes you feel proud when you walk into them, just to see how the preservation is carried out. Everything's spot on.
Didn't think you were going to get saved to Gallipoli?
No, we knew we were never going to Gallipoli because we ran to France, we drive. we joined the 4th Division, one of the regular army divisions, and we knew that we had never taken away the greater commitment. It was the Southern Divisions from Ireland that went to Gallipoli, the 10th Irish went to Gallipoli. But we didn't know, we went to France only. France and Belgium. We moved from one front to another occasion. But there was no transport in those days. Not like today, soldier. We had you did 25 miles a day when you were shipped from one front to another. And you started at 6 o'clock in the morning to march. And you did 4 miles, then a break. 4 miles, then a break. Soldier marches. He marches 4 miles to the hour. And you have a break for 10 minutes. Sometimes you'd get a... That when you had a cook cart on parade, you'd have got a Dixie full of tea and a sandwich. And on you got the game. But you lay on the ground. There was no beds or anything like that. You just stretched your ground sheet and got onto it. No beds or slept in the hedge. What did we used to do in the warm weather was take our tunic off and put our feet on the sleeve and buckle the tunic for like this. In the summertime, the hardship was nothing like the winter time, because getting to sleep and keeping yourself warm, that was the most difficult times of all. But the marching, when you had a good band that wasn't so bad, you used to feel your shoulders, the weight. You had 186 pounds on your shoulder, and when you got it off, you were pleased. But you'd seen the boys beginning to lag a wee bit as they were getting near the end. But the audience was always used the psychology, and he was dashed up to the barn and made them strike up one of the airs, you know, that everybody could see the chest coming out and go forward again. Oh no.
Well, the bell's gone, at least boys have got to get away now.
Well, I'm not keeping it. If there's anything you still want to know, just sing out.
Thank you very much, and on behalf of the boys and myself, of course, I'd like to thank you very much for coming up and making the war seem a little more real to you. And the book hopefully means a bit more to the student now. And thank you very much.
I'd like you all to rest assured it's a pleasure for me to do it.